but it gave advertising a black eye.
This episode is brought to you by Article, and summer is on its way, thank God. Have you thought about your outdoor space? I can't wait to spend time lounging outdoors. You want to make the most of that space. So, what are we talking about? Sharing meals, watching movies, falling asleep on the outdoor sofa. Everything is better al fresco. Article has a curated catalog of outdoor furniture to help you to do all of this. I'm talking about dining sets, decor, sofas, everything you might possibly need. I got a bunch of this stuff at home, and it was last weekend, like spring cleaning style. It's just like that's a pleasant chore when you dust off that patio furniture and bring it outside, knowing that you're going to have some good times on it and thinking about all the nice weather ahead. Article will get you the patio furniture you need fast. They have a curated assortment of mid-century, modern, coastal, industrial, Scandinavian, and bohemian designs. They make furniture shopping simple. Their stuff is really nice, well-made, stylish, and affordable. You can try it out. They want you to try it out, so they're offering an incredible deal through us. Because you listen to this podcast, you get $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more. To claim this, just visit article.com/CanadaLand. The discount is automatically applied at checkout, so go have a look at the stuff, article.com/CanadaLand, for $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more. Are you a philosophical guy? Like, there's a whole conversation about how the culture of ultra-commercialization gets into people's identities, and you know, and it's interesting under the influence. Which it's interesting that actually, you know, the phrase itself is about being drunk, you know, but being intoxicated.
Right.
But now, of course, influence has a different connotation because everyone's an influencer, or we live in the age of the influencer.
That's why a part of the reason why we changed the name of our show. So the show was Age of Persuasion in the early days.
Uh-huh.
I mean, our show started before there was an iPhone, before there was YouTube, before there was Twitter. All of that didn't exist in 2005. It was still a persuasive industry. I had to persuade you to buy something. It was, let me just shovel all of this onto you as an advertiser. Then when the digital world came in, it really became a lot more subtle. Algorithms, influencers. So really, in 2012, we changed the whole format of our show to reflect that.
Yeah, it's a broader category and a more current one because to persuade someone, yes, it's salesy, but you're having a conversation with them and you're making an argument. Influence is not necessarily a conversation. Influence is pervasive and we surround you with values and images and little signals to slowly influence how you feel about things.
But in one way, it is a conversation because in the old days of persuasion, it was a one-way conversation. You really couldn't talk back to an advertiser.
Right.
In this day and age with social media, you can talk back to an advertiser. You can get the president of a company's attention as a 12-year-old girl on Twitter if you had the right message. So there has to be a lot more transparency now. Not that there's total transparency, but you can see someone who has a problem with a marketer, puts it out on Twitter, for example. Then we get a front row seat to see how they react to that.
I think it's a valid point that the people have a bit more of a voice, and we've seen, you know, funny stories of brands that get it wrong and somebody, they just become a laughingstock and people
right.
take turns dunking on them. But, you know, there's always a period where there's a bit of chaos and the
yeah.
power gets unsettled, and then the empire strikes back and they figure out and Wendy's gets funny and starts making fun of McDonald's
right.
and they kind of co-opt, you know, the rebel voice.
Yeah.
And the predominant theme is very different than, like, as a Gen Xer when we used to say, oh, that band sold out. And now I look at the YouTubers who my kids are watching, and it's like everyone wants to sell out. Like, that's the dream. It's like, wow, this guy is an influencer. All he does is he gets stuff for free.
Yeah.
And we don't care that he's getting it for free or why he's getting it for free. And, oh, my God, they're paying him.
Yeah.
And, well, is he only saying that because they're paid? No, like the cool thing is that he's getting paid.
Right.
And in a wider sense, what is, like, I don't know, Instagram culture, but everybody advertising a version of their lifestyle. So like the way in which we've internalized brand and like,
everybody is a brand now.
Everybody is a brand. That is, to a certain perspective, hell.
Well, it is if you're going to buy right into it, because then you have to cultivate and curate your life.
Yeah.
Right. And there's a lot of that going on. There's no doubt about that. I mean, we hear interviews and stories all the time about how it's negatively affecting a lot of, especially younger people, that they feel they look at those wonderful lives and think, my life is nothing like that, and then can suffer depression and things could get worse. So there's a lot of downsides to it.
Do you think it's like we need better regulation.
I don't know how you would regulate that.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you ask me that, what do you think when you say that? Is there a way?
Well, they're trying. They're trying with really broad strokes to just basically take kids off of social media, you know, and...
good luck with that.
Yeah. Opt-outs and parents having total access to their kids' account. That's the, you know, is it Ohio has a rule now? And there's a really strong reason to be worried about that. You know, you talk about, let's say, a kid who's come out to a community of friends as queer and their parents don't know about it yet, and you've legislated that the parents have access to every one of their accounts, or you cut off somebody's access to a community that's actually helping them. And not, like, there's a very reductive view that it's only negative and in knocking every kid off. And then, of course, like you say, good luck. They're going to find some other way.
Yeah.
So, no, I tend to agree. And government doesn't tend to be super good at this. I don't know. It's not a topic I know a tremendous amount about. I know there are laws around disclosing sponsorship.
Yeah.
And I know
that is a big law. If you're an influencer, you're supposed to disclose that you're being paid for that. I mean, there's big fines in the U.S. I'm not sure how much it's done in Canada, but if you don't disclose that you're being paid or you've gotten product in lieu of the endorsement, it can be a big problem. Some people have been fined big amounts of money.
Yeah, so there's a place for regulation there. And then when it comes to kids, I know there's like all kinds of little, you know, specific things. And of course, when you get to dangerous products, there's, you know.
Right.
Well, I don't know. I guess they can do something. I don't want to just say, oh, yeah, forget it. But I guess I tend to feel like we have to work this out in the culture.
Yeah.
I know the ad industry, like every other industry where there's been a moral panic, turns to self-regulation to get ahead of the regulators.
Right.
So you've got all these ad boards and internal mechanisms. Yep. You know, but the technology has moved so much faster than people's understanding of it or these regulatory bodies.
That is so true. I mean, think about all the changes that we've seen in just the last few years in the digital world. I go back to the era, Jesse, where my first radio job, I was telling you about, all the sound effects were on vinyl records.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'd have bird chirps, door barks, you know, pull them out, put them down, drop the needle, find the right doorbell, ring, run to the studio, transfer it to tape. Like all of that was gone.
Yeah.
It's all gone now, right? Editing with a razor blade and a wax pencil. I mean, it's moving so fast now that you almost can't keep up. Like look at the TikTok thing that's going on now with the governments suspecting that TikTok is really this very sticky, addictive app to gain information. Right?
Is the accusation, yeah.
Is the accusation, yeah.
That's right. And, I mean, it would be fascinating to do a under the influence on this stuff, but I don't know that we can, or, I challenge you to do so.
No,
when
I know.
We're talking about things like, you know, your show is so much about getting into the creative human process of people who are, you know, artists in their way, creators, how they're shaping these things and having fun conversations about how to reach people and looking at the market. And that is a process that is rapidly getting automated and subjected to automated A-B testing where, you know, the question of should we go with this message or should we go with that message, the machine is giving us the answer. It runs both messages and it tells you which one won. And then their generation of the messages themselves is increasingly going to be automated by artificial intelligence.
Right.
And we're getting to a place where how do you tell the story of an algorithm's rapid-fire decision-making?
I know. It makes it tough on me. And where's the creativity, too? Like, with all that automation, is there going to be creativity? Is creativity going to become a thing of the past? Is advertising not even going to want creativity anymore? Is it the math men and not the mad men anymore? Like, what's that going to turn into?
It's very hazy. The AI itself, I don't think, can be considered creative because it is just shuffling existing materials.
Yeah.
But the creation of the AI is the act of creativity.
Right.
And the writing of the algorithm, which we increasingly talk about as if it's just sort of like handed down from the mount. No, somebody actually said, this is what this line of code should do.
Yep.
So the focus shifts. As much as we pat ourselves on the back in this conversation, or, you know, it's my fault, as pioneers of a new digital media, I kind of feel like we have something that has a lot more in common with the past than with where things are going. And everything from the host read ad to simply asking people to sit down with us for 20, 30, 40 minutes and listen to a conversation or a story. I love how quaint and anachronistic that is. Like, attention spans are getting divided and subdivided and subdivided.
In some mediums, right?
So we're the holdout. I can't think of anywhere else.
I know.
And that's the one
movies
thing that we...
Movies, maybe. I mean, movies are still 2 hours long.
Movies are the closest, and that's actually the answer I get when talking about podcast advertising. I say, listen, you know, we price our ads accordingly because where else can you get 60 seconds of a person's time to hear about your product?
Totally. 60s were the yachts of advertising and disappeared in the 80s. Advertising went from probably 2 minutes back in the day, being embedded in Jack Benny's show where he talked probably for 4 or 5 minutes, down to 60 seconds, down to 30 seconds, down to 15 seconds, down to 10 seconds, down to 6 second YouTube ads, where I never really bought that. I understand that it's more efficient as a media buying. You can, you know, buy a lot more small chunks than big ones, but there's no creativity. There's no brand building in that. And it's not enjoyable. It's like getting a slap across the face really quickly. There's no real creativity. There's no interesting, you know, I always say connect the dots when you have a brand, that every little touch point is an opportunity. All of that goes away in that scenario,
which I
think is terrible.
And it's not just advertising. The notion that you have a split second to grab somebody's attention or else it goes somewhere else, they're making movies that way. You know, the Marvel movie format, the pace of these things is like they're just slapping you in the face again and again and again. They can't build tension, or they can't like create any like the quiet moments that make the loud moments work.
Right.
Because it's just pummeling you constantly.
Really? And if you want to, you know, carbon date that, that's really as a result of MTV. Because all that fast cut editing when MTV showed up, I mean, that totally influenced my industry. Like once we saw that you can get 30 cuts in 30 seconds, which we'd never even thought of before, we started doing that. And then you can see that ball rolling down the hill and affecting advertising and movies and television shows and Miami Vice and all of that, right?
So I'm a cranky old man because I feel like I've found this little lonely island of podcasting that it's still this immersive long form experience.
Well, I wouldn't call you a lonely old man. I think it is. I think it's a wonderful thing. I think the very fact, as you said, that you can spend time with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
It's a funny thing. When I would do what they're called upfronts with CBC, and for those who don't know what that is, that's when they parade out all the hosts for all the shows in front of advertisers or in front of an audience, and they get to talk about all their shows, and then the public gets to meet you. So it'll be held in the Eaton Center or something like
sure.
that. I would watch people come up to the television hosts, and they'd be very tentative, and they would sort of back away and be afraid to talk to them. And when they came to talk to us radio hosts, they were always touching me. And I was really uncomfortable with it at first. Like, they'd always shake hands but not let go, or hold my hand and my elbow, or put their arm around. It was a strange thing that I was really uncomfortable with. And what I came to realize was it was that thing about audio, Jesse, that people feel connected to the hosts, personally connected to the hosts, because we spend time with them, because it's a voice in their ear. It's not really a communal event. It's really a one-on-one. Television has a lot of awe, but audio has this real sense of connection. And that's why they were always touching.
You've heard the term parasocial relationship?
No.
That's what people have with their favorite. I have it with my favorite podcast hosts.
Yeah.
I mean, you bring them into your home. You bring them in as you're washing the dishes or as you're driving in your car by yourself. It's one-on-one, as you say. And it's like a pretty regular thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like once a week or something.
Yeah.
So, yeah, people feel like they know. They know you. I mean, you have been in people's homes for 18 years.
That's right. That's right. And I came to realize that it was an incredible compliment. That when people had that kind of, that familiarity with you, that they could cross that line and come right into your zone, you know, and I actually got to like it after a while. I really, truly did.
Touch Terry O'Reilly.
yeah, touch me, yo.
Terry, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thanks, Jesse. That was terrific. I enjoyed it.
That's your Canada Land. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read them all. We're on Twitter at CanadaLand. Our website is canadaland.com. Our audio editor and technical producer is Tristan Capicchione. This show's senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Welcome, Bruce. Our managing editor is Annette Ejofor. Special thanks this week to my colleagues Dory Smith and Jessica Valentin. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Danny Parody, former Canada Land contributing editor, current APTN Alberta reporter, and friend who once gifted me a souvenir from the Icelandic Phallological Museum. Thank you for coming on.
Happy to be here, and I hope you still have that keychain.
I absolutely do. I believe it's on my desk at home. So today on the show, Tucker and Tarek, the most extreme voice in mainstream English language media anywhere, got fired, and the most extreme voice in Canada's mainstream English language media passed away. I'm Jonathan Goldsby. This is Shortcuts, on which we talk about the news. On Monday, Tarek Fatah passed away. Danny, what do you know about Tarek Fatah?
Tarek Fatah, to me, was always a Sun commentator, I would call him. He was a Pakistani-Canadian journalist and author. He really ran the gamut on like public opinion, I guess. Like, I would say, if you consider his early career, from what I understand, he advocated for LGBT rights. He was interested in separation of church and state. I suppose we could call that kind of like classical liberal and maybe somewhat progressive policies. But over time, that's not what he became. He increasingly drew to the right. He advocated against, like, in kind of a really vague way, Sharia law without defining what that meant exactly. He once called friend of the show Omar Mualim a Sharia Bolshevik.
I was impressed by the National Post obituary for him. By Tyler Dawson, ran under the headline, Complicated Legacy for Columnist Tarek Fatah, hailed by family as voice for underdog. In the second and third paragraphs, explained, in more than a decade of writing columns for The Sun, Fatah distinguished himself with his acidic opinions on Islam and contempt for religious extremists and Pakistan nationalists. He also, in his later years, veered sharply to the right, supporting Donald Trump, promoting Kremlin propaganda on the war in Ukraine, and siding with the Assad regime against Syrian rebels. He is definitely one of the most fascinating, interesting, and strangest characters to emerge in the Canadian media landscape in the past two decades. Just to give us a little more background, he is from Pakistan. He was a journalist there in the 70s, moved to Saudi Arabia to work in advertising for much of the 80s, came to Canada in the late 80s, was an NDPer for a very long time, even ran for the Ontario New Democratic Party when Bob Rae was going for re-election in the mid-90s, worked for Bob Rae. Then he started hosting a show on CTS, which was a Christian television channel, called the Old Muslim Chronicle. And then after 9/11, he co-founded a group called the Muslim Canadian Congress and really started cultivating, not really in persona, but like doing a lot of advocacy around and doing a lot of speaking around the issues, basically moderate Islam. He would be the person who would often appear, he and, like, for example, Irshad Manji, who was another author, were often people who would appear on very much mainstream Canadian media, on things like CBC, on TVO, Maclean's, about basically they're framed as like, okay, these are the good ones.
The Muslims who are moderate, who are slightly liberal, secular practicing, pay a very heavy price because they have assimilated and embraced Canadian society. So people like me don't look like Muslims. So who does the media or the politician talk to? A men and women who wear religion on the sleeve.
Framing himself very much as moderate Islam. Now, obviously, you have to remember, and especially in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, there was, you know, a lot of racism out there. And he basically was a person who would basically held himself up as, and was held up by others as, a pointedly moderate voice, a critic of radical Islam, but someone who himself was moderate and showing a more peaceful path forward, perhaps you could say. That's not itself unproblematic by any means, but over the following decades, the issues with that premise became more and more apparent. And then around 2012, he became a regular columnist for the Toronto Sun and made appearances on Sun News Network. And then 2017, he briefly hosted a show on ZTV in India, which he said reclaimed got like 100 million viewers a week, which I don't know enough about Indian TV to be able to assess the plausibility of that, but sure. At least as far back as maybe the mid-2000s, 2007, there were already sort of signs that maybe he was a bit more on the lookout for, I guess, what he would term Islamists or extreme forms of Islam than might be helpful. In 2007, he co-authored a Toronto Sun column with Farzana Hassan called Little Masquerade on the Prairie, which was taking to task CBC's then new series, Little Mosque on the Prairie, for basically advancing what he described as an Islamist agenda. He believed that the way the show depicted Muslims and non-Muslims may have been a deliberate distortion. What he described is exaggerate the incidence of racism and bigotry against Muslims in Canada to foster the culture of victimhood and accentuate the chasm between Muslims and non-Muslims in Canada. That theme kind of grew and grew throughout his writing, throughout his output. So in his Sun columns gradually became, you know, more and more Toronto Sunny. Over the course of the years, the headlines like Face Reality, Many Muslims Support ISIS, Beware the Islamophobia Racket, How Canadian MPs Got Duped into an Anti-Islamophobia Motion, Burqas, Niqabs Pose Public Safety Risk, and There Is No Islamophobia in Canada. That last one was in response to the outpouring of support for the Muslim community that followed the allegedly hate-motivated killings of four members of a Muslim family in London, Ontario. He wrote, If it's true that Islamophobia exists in Canada, then our country is not alone. Wherever we Muslims live or have moved as a minority, the fact is it is our behavior in relations to the majority and our contempt for the host community's religion and civilization has aroused in them the supposed irrational fear of our faith. Basically, in the article, it's just saying that, yeah, if Islamophobia does exist in Canada, Muslims basically bring it upon themselves. And these are opinions that, honestly, even by the standards of what you'd see in the Toronto Sun, in other elsewhere in English language mainstream Canadian media, this is unusual, especially in the timing of it. And not surprisingly, like even then, his columns in the Sun were very much, they're still fairly moderated, as Laurie Goldstein, his longtime editor, wrote in his obituary of Fatah the other day. Editing a column by Tarek was both a joy and an adventure. I can't recall how many times I said to him over the years, Tarek, you can't say that, it's libelous. He would always defend his position, vigorously. But he was never a prima donna, and we could always work out a compromise that satisfied both Tarek and the Sun's lawyers.
That's quite the statement. It was like, oh, you can't say that it's libelous, and they would just get to a point where it was, you know, you could hedge enough that the bigotry that you're spewing is like, justifiable.
Probably try and name individuals, mm-hmm. and they'd find different ways to phrase things or say things. It's an interesting thing to include in an obituary. Mm-hmm. It's like, I thought he was trying to defame people all the time, but thankfully he let me talk him down from that.
That so-and-so.
Like a lot of people, especially a lot of people maybe of his age, a lot of people in media and a lot of people we may have in our families, you could see a particular progression in the way he thought about the world over the past decade or so.
Anyone worried about Western civilization will have to vote for Trump. Anyone who's naive and stupid or ridiculous or small-minded and petty will vote for that crooked woman who will destroy the United States of America.
He's someone who is very online, and you could see how certain things in his personality were maybe exacerbated by being deeply online.
Then you say why people are getting the news from social media. Hallelujah, let them get it. They're sick and tired of Marxist millionaires. So please, next time you meet a journalist, take a cake and slam it into his face, because that's what he deserves.
Having his own, maybe his own past traumas and his own experience in Pakistan has been his own view of South Asian politics and how a lot of that was very much amplified and exacerbated by much of what was in media and particularly conservative and far-right media over the past decade. And you can really see his Sun columns were not great, but what was more surprising is that he maintained that column as he was able to offer his unvarnished opinions on social media, on Twitter and on Facebook. I guess I'll say one very characteristic tweet, probably the most, the crystallization of everything, was in March 2016 when he said, as time the world came to a realization, Pakistan is a cancerous tumor on the face of humanity. If not surgically removed, it'll kill us all. That's the only time I can recall a mainstream Canadian columnist seemingly advocating for, if not genocide, then certainly for a country to be wiped off the face of the earth and being able to carry on as though that had never happened.
Mm-hmm.
Like the editor of The Sun, Adrian Batra, would often, and many people would often point to Tarek Fatah as like, how could The Sun be Islamophobic? We have a Muslim columnist.
Right.
you know, arguably the most openly Islamophobic English language columnist in mainstream media in Canada, go on conspiracy theories about, you know, a Muslim accomplice in the Quebec City mosque shooting, going on about, you know, Hillary Clinton friends who mysteriously turned up dead, thinking that the Obama administration has been infiltrated by the Muslim Brotherhood. And they're just outright, like, tweeting about Trudeau should STFU shut the f*** up, pretty boy, and then calling, like, London Mayor Sadiq Khan a polished piece of shit. And then they're from, you know, from there going to the things the Post alluded to, which is, you know, very, you know, buying very much Putin-type lines on the war in Ukraine or siding with the Assad regime. And originally, when I thought about talking about this, I wanted, like, oh, what an awful person he was. And I feel like after reading about his whole career and taking it all in and looking at and really charting his writings and comments over the past 20 years or so, realizing it's just really sad. It's really, really sad what happened to him, in the sense of he got sucked into, I don't know what you want to call it. I guess it's similar to what we were alluding to in the previous segment about this right wing and or far right. This is more than a rabbit hole. I don't even know what you would call. I'm not even sure what animal burrows this deep or this far. Or it's seeing certain aspects that were already in a person's personality and maybe had been turned towards, had been able to channel to certain ends, and seeing those gradually be almost activated or exacerbated or turned against all kinds of other things. It's basically radicalization. And because of, like, he is someone who is so prolific, both in his columns and in social media and in appearances, he is someone you can really, really, to a remarkable degree of detail, track this radicalization over time. And I guess what distinguishes him from a lot of other people is he actually managed to keep his Toronto Sun column right up until, if he hadn't passed away, he'd still have it. His last column was last February.
I think where we're left off is just, like, this is the danger of being too online. Like, it, we've seen this with similar people where you're kind of forced to increasingly inhabit a more extreme viewpoint. It's not good for your brain.
Shortcuts for this week. Thank you so much for joining me, Danny.
Anytime.
We are on Twitter still at CanadaLand. You can email me at jonathan@canadaland.com. I too am still on Twitter, I guess. I read everything you send. Where can people find you, Danny?
You can still find me on Twitter, still there, at Danny Paradis, or you can email me dparadis, P-A-R-A-D-I-S, at aptn.ca.
This episode was produced by a heroic Aviva Lessard, with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofo. Theme music is by So-Called, syndication by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Thank you for supporting CanadaLand.
This is Bird Note. In this show, we use a bamboo bird whistle to demonstrate variations in the song of a single song sparrow. Heidi Holting, a musician, listens carefully to the songs of birds.
One morning, I was in dreamland and I heard this very loud rhythm coming through my window, and it woke me up. Well, I decided I was going to try to write down the rhythm, so it went. What was really noticeable was that it had three parts to the song. The first part, and then a kind of a buzzing, and then five regular notes. Okay, so then one day I noticed that the song was different, and it went, you know, day after day, I just kept, there's another one. Oh, there's another one. And I kept writing them down.
In all, Heidi documented 13 variations.
What's happened in this later stage of life, with the kids gone and the pets gone, is that I'm beginning to perceive the complexity of all the life forms that have been around me all along, that I thought of, oh, as those are birds. And now they're not just birds, they're 100 kinds of birds with 100 songs.
For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.